I don't know. You just got me in a crazy mood, man. It's not my fault.
Maybe it was that sake.
I'm not to blame. Them damn drugs. My name's Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gable Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I since January 25th, 1981. It's a privilege to be here with you guys, and I actually did pop up. You know, I've been sneezing. I've had a runny nose, watery eyes. So the reason I'm late is because I drove to a CVS pharmacy and I said, "Give me something that'll stop all that, but not make me drowsy." And I think he gave me heroin or something. I don't know what it is. So I'm not to blame for whatever comes out of my mouth. I'm totally on drugs. So whatever the stuff is, they gave me to stop the allergy or whatever it is. So it's good to be here. I'm gonna talk about basically two. I'm talking about two parts of the book, I think, today. We're sort of like on the eighth step, eighth and nine, things like that. And there's a couple of parts of the book I want to talk about. One of my favorite parts that I talk about all the time is in chapter five. You know, if we're going to talk about the eighth step and what it means to me and how it's changed my life, I want to tell you a little bit also about my personal testimony. And that's this part right here, which we talk about all the time, if I could find it, in this little big book, in the chapter of how it works. I know it by heart, but I'm not going to do it that way. Here it is. Selfishness, self-centeredness. By the way, the big book, somewhere along the line, says men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The effect is to make you not sober. Because if you're sober, this is hard to get across to people sometimes. If you're sober, you don't feel that good, even when you think you're feeling good. Although, why would you drink? You drink to feel better, to feel different. So, and I was drinking all the time. So, men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. As a matter of fact, if you don't like sobriety and you're an alcoholic like me, alcohol is the best drug for that deal. You understand? It works very fast, and it gets you exactly where you want to go. And if it still works on me the way it worked on me when I was 20 years old, I'd still be drinking it, but it doesn't work on me anymore, so I don't drink it. And sad news about my life, it stopped working on me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working on me. And did I say my name is Russell? I'm an alcoholic. You know, when you're 65, not that that's too old. I hang around with a lot of guys 85, so it makes me feel young. I was talking to a buddy of mine who's got like 27 years, and he was bemoaning the fact that he had to wait an hour in a doctor's office. And he was complaining about that, and I said, you know, when you get to my age, you tend to hang around those offices where older people hang around. You don't go to pediatricians anymore, so you tend to hang around offices where everybody's like in their 80s. You know, you're going there for all sorts of things like prostate cancer, whatever the hell you go to, but they're all like, you know, 70, 80, 90 years old. And if you ever watch a doctor's office when you hang around with guys, you know, over 70, they're never bothered. They're just sort of like, they're just happy to hang out there. And, I mean, they can hang out there all day, you know, it doesn't matter, you know. I mean, I told them, just get a magazine, one of them nifty mags they have, Red Book or something, and just start chewing on that sucker, you know. And, you know, that's, you know, things start, you know, actually, you know, things start calming down for you after a while. And, when I'm in a doctor's office, I feel it's just like another ALF for me, you know, another assisted living facility. And actually, this is what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about living a comfortable life. That's what this is all about, living a comfortable life. Has anybody ever noticed that when you first come into Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe for a long while afterwards, sometimes life can be painful? You know what I think is painful? What's real painful for alcoholics? Having conflicts with people. You know, if you have a fight with somebody, if you have a conflict with somebody, if you got somebody on your mind, that thing can last for weeks and years. It can be real painful. You can have conflicts with a lot of people. You have a lot of stuff going on. You go to sleep, you think about it. You wake up, you think about it. It just sort of ruins the moment for a long time. So, in any event, I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Now, I didn't know, you know, when you're an alcoholic, you don't know that you don't like being sober. You don't, this sort of stuff I'm saying now, like sobriety is painful for me. Maybe women drink because I like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, they're irritable, they're discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You don't know that. You can't put that into words. But you know one thing. You know things like this. You know, like, I need a drink. That's what you know. You know, you don't know that you're restless, you're able to, you just know you need a damn drink. That's what you know. And you know, when an alcoholic says, I need a drink, it's not like he's not playing around. It's not just saying that. You know, he's saying, I need a drink. We need to get drunk. I need a drink. You know, where's the booze? Who brought the booze? We're playing golf today. Who's bringing the booze? You know, well, there's going to be no booze. I'm not playing, you know. That's it. We're going fishing. Who's got the booze? You know, when I fished, I had a drink. And I had a drink when I fished because fishing without drinking is painful. And when I was playing golf, I'd have a drink because playing golf without drinking is painful, you know. When I was in a bar, you know, with a bunch of my buddies, I had a drink because being in a bar with your buddies without drinking is painful. You know, it's uncomfortable. You know, I was out to dinner, I had to drink, because being out to dinner with friends is uncomfortable unless you're drinking. And when I was dancing, I had to drink because dancing without drinking is painful. Having sex without drinking can be painful. It's awkward, you know. I like to have sex when I'm drunk, you know. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know. I don't know. I'm sure you guys are laughing. You don't know what it's like, but as a matter of fact, I used to drink a lot all the time, you know. I used to drink for no particular reason. Being awake was good enough for me. And so it was painful because life's painful. You don't know life is painful because when life is always painful, it doesn't feel like it's painful. It just feels like, you know, pretty much life. I mean, the truth is, here's the interesting deal. Now I'm 33, a little over 33 years sober, and life hasn't been painful for me for a long time. I mean, I hate to say that. I know when I used to hear guys say that, I remember when I was about 2 years sober and some gal had about 12 years and she started being insane, talking about how wonderful her life is, and I hated her. I don't like, you know, when you feel bad, you don't want to hear anybody with this wonderful shit, you know. And But I got to tell the truth, things are pretty damn good. Not anything circumstantially. Well, circumstantially they actually become good because you stop stepping in potholes and bumping into spiritual walls and doing all sorts of stupid stuff. But I'm talking about inside. It's not painful. But when your life becomes unpainful, when you don't have people messing around in your head and you're not worried about stuff and you're not anxious and your mind isn't going a million miles per hour and you go for long periods of time without any thought whatsoever and you can sit in the doctor's office for 2 hours and it doesn't bother you and life just doesn't bother you because you're less botherable. When that actually happens, not that it ever gets perfect, you never have a bad moment or anything, but when it gets unpainful, sometimes you can look back and remember how painful. Then you can compare, you understand, the way you feel now to the way you felt before you even came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And you say, you can actually think in your mind, man, I could have never done this. I could have never done this before I came in. Or even during my first 10 years, I could have never done this. And you start realizing that, you know, life just isn't affecting you that way. You know, people aren't affecting you. The traffic isn't affecting you. Stuff isn't affecting you. And you get the sponsor people who sit next to you and jump up and down and, you know, like a propeller and go bananas over nothing. And they look at you and they say, doesn't this bother you? And you go, no. They don't understand that. But I understand them. I understand what's going on with them because they're upsettable. So men and women drink because they're upsettable, because they're irritable, restless. And so the rest of our program, the rest of this deal is to make you less so, to make you not like that. Because if you're not like that, if life becomes the joy of living, it becomes joyous, then drinking becomes unnecessary because you're actually doing better not drinking than you were ever doing when you were drinking. As a matter of fact, a lot of stuff becomes unnecessary. You know, having to spend money on stuff that you can't afford to impress people you don't like and to make yourself feel better. You don't have to do a whole... You see, you don't have to be on that that life's mission to find that man, woman, thing, or circumstances to make yourself feel better. You're not on the hunt to make yourself feel better because you already are better. You know, you've already lived that turnover life and you're exactly where you want to be. There's no other place you want to be. You don't have to go on the trip. You don't have to spend the money. You don't have to go, you really don't have to go on the cruise. That doesn't mean you can't go on the cruise, but you don't have to go on the cruise. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to be a member of the country club. You don't have to play golf. You don't have to climb the mountain. You don't have to get laid. You don't have to do anything because you're okay right here, right now, exactly where you are with whoever you're with. You're like your own amusement park, you know what I mean? And of course, if you happen to be lucky enough to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, well, that's pretty much a pretty good amusement park right there, you know what I mean? Just sit around and watch and you say, man, this is too good to be true. This is better than any reality TV whatsoever. And every once in a while you get to be helpful. Oh, well, in any event. So here's the deal. So let's talk about that painful life. And so what caused that painful life? Now, here's the deal. Selfishness, self-centeredness. You know, here's the interesting thing. If you're dealing with alcoholics that are in denial, and they usually don't think they're selfish and self-centered, the most difficult thing, I think, for an alcoholic is to really see how selfish they are, since we all think that we're selfless and wonderful. You see, here's the thing. We think we're victims, and we think we're sensitive, and we think we're self... You see, as an alcoholic, I was given two gifts. The first gift I was given is the gift of unbelievable sensitivity. I am a very sensitive person, just like all of you guys, you know what I mean? And I've never seen anybody feel injustice the way I feel injustice. I've never seen anybody look like they feel. I've never seen anybody as sensitive as I am, okay? And the second gift you're given, the second gift, which is extraordinary, and it's very useful at times, is an incredible callousness and insensitivity to the feelings of other people. I mean, we don't really give a shit, you know what I mean? But, you know, when you're very, very sensitive, and all you do is think about your feelings and how you feel, there's really very little room. There's very few neurons left to think about the other person. You understand what I'm saying? So that's a good deal, because then you don't have to worry about feeling guilty for anything you do. You don't even have to think about anything you do. You just think about how it affects you. Now, I'm talking, you know, after a few years of sobriety and realizing what's going on with me and all that sort of stuff. It's not like I want you to think like I walked in day thinking this shit. You know what I mean? Like, you kidding me? So here's what it says. So you spend a whole lot of time in the first 10 or 15 years just trying to ultimately realize what an asshole you are. Not you guys. I'm not including the people in this group. As you know, I hold you guys in high esteem. You are probably the cream of the crop when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Pretty much talking about my home group and myself. Selfishness, for whatever it's worth, just in case some of you might identify with this, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear. See, it comes in different forms. 100 forms, or maybe 100 forms. That means if you've recognized 20, you got like 80 to go that you don't even know about. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, that means like deluded, you're deluded. Self-seeking and self-pity. I was a self-pityaholic man from the get-go. We step on the toes of others, of our fellows, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based upon self, which later placed us into a position to be hurt. And then it says, above everything, we've got to get rid of the selfishness we must if it kills us. So I want to talk about decisions based upon self and how that affects your uncomfortability, you know, your restlessness. Now, I don't know much that makes you more uncomfortable than the feelings of guilt. Guilt. Now, I was a Jewish kid from New York, so I know all about guilt, you know. You know, I had a Jewish mother, but whether you're Catholic, same thing. It's guilt, guilt, guilt. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story. This is a true story. I've probably mentioned a little bit about it before. I tell shorthand versions of it, but I have three daughters, and they're all are married except one of the last ones about to get married. They're all married, very nice guys, and they're young and in love, and you know, like in their 20s and stuff, you know? I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, when you're 20 years old and you're getting married and you're in love, you know, you look so, they look so innocent, so wonderful. You know, that's probably the way I look. I probably look that way. We probably look that way. We just married this beautiful gal, and we were young and in love, and we got married and married this great gal. She came from a very nice family, fine family, non-alcoholic, nice gal. And after we got married, I went to work for the state's attorney's office. I got a job. I was making some money. She was making some money. We were doing our thing. We had our first child, beautiful little child. We had a house on Miami Beach, and everything was going fine except that one thing, except for a thing that used to bother her. And that what apparently bothered her, I don't, you know, somebody asked me, well, what bothered her is that I was drinking too much, you know, and isn't that a shocker? So in any event, now, after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to tell you a little story about that drinking too much and how it led to my divorce, but after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody asked me at some point in time, says, do you remember your wife ever commenting on your drinking? Or saying, and the truth of the matter is, I was married for 5 years, and I never remember my first wife saying anything about my drinking. Anything. Even when I fell asleep in the Caesar salad at, you know, the English pub. I don't remember her ever saying anything about my drinking, except for the very last time, right before I got a divorce. And it was like, apparently, now my gut feeling is she was probably talking about it a lot. I just didn't, maybe she was like whispering, because maybe I didn't hear it. You know, it's possible, you know, that she mentioned something about my drinking. But what happened was, one Friday, she said to me, and I've told this story before to make a different time point. She said to me, I came out and I was, I don't know, 25, 26, 27, whatever I was, and I was all dressed up in my blue suit and my white shirt and my red tie and ready to go to work and drive off to work. And my son was there, and she said, and she looked up, she looked at me and she said, I just want you to know, you come home one more time, I'm drunk, I'm leaving you. That's what she said to me. And she wasn't joking. She said to me, she just delivered the line, like delivering the mail, and that was it. There was no talking about it. There was no argument. You come home drunk. It was a Friday. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Now, what I usually say at meetings when I talk about that story to make a point on something else, you know, 12 little words is that I drove down the street and I hit the first light and I go, you know, what the hell did she mean by that? Which is true. You know, I didn't get it, you know, because you're given that incredible, because one of the reasons you don't get it is because you are given this incredible insensitivity to how you're affecting other people. I mean, the reason she said that is because I was ripping her heart out, but I didn't see any blood, I didn't see any heart, I didn't see any problem. I didn't see any problem. To me, there was no problem. Because my modus operandi was this, that every Friday night, and I'm not just saying this was just Fridays, but definitely every Friday night, I would get to the bar about 4:30 to hang out with my drinking buddies, the only people that really understood me. And I would get into the bar and I'd order my one drink, which was usually a double scotch. So I already started with two, you know. And I would whack that down, and then I'd order another one because I was a fast drinker. And what I would do is I would sit in the bar, and my wife would be at home with my 3 or 4 year old son, and she would be fixing dinner. My wife was a wonderful gal. She had this concept that what you did when you were married is that you ate dinner together with your son and you showed up and that kind of stuff. You know, I have no idea where she got that from. But in any event, so it would be around, I would be in the bar from 4:30 to 6:30 drinking, and then I would call up my wife and I would say to her, honey, I just got to the bar, which, you know, in geologic terms, 2 hours is really just getting there. You know what I mean? If you're an alcoholic. And I would tell her, I'm going to be there shortly. And she says, well, okay, because I've cooked dinner. I cooked the pot roast, whatever she cooked. I said, I'll be there shortly. And then I would be in the bar, and I continued to drink for about another 2 hours until it was around 8:30. And then I would call up, and I'd say, honey, I got caught up with something. I would say something, make some excuse, you know, because I was still at that point in time in my life where I could drink and not slur my words after 4 hours of drinking. And she'd be a little frosty on the phone. She'd say, well, you know, the dinner's getting cold. We've been working, waiting. Your son hasn't eaten. It's 8:30. He says, because I was only 15 minutes away across the causeway. I said, I'll be home, and you know, shortly, in 15 minutes. And then I would drink there for another hour until it was like 9:30 at night. And then I would call her up again, and I would, and she'd answer the phone. It was like it was a little frosty at that point. You know what I mean? At 9:30 after waiting for 3 hours. And she, you know, say something. She was obviously mad. And then I would say this. I'd say, I'm out the door. Which was true. I was out the door. I went to another bar. And then I would show up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's what I did all the time. And I thought nothing of it. Nothing of it. I did that for 5 years straight. You understand what I'm saying? So that's what it was like to live with me. But you got to understand, I'm a very sensitive and wonderful guy. You understand what I'm saying? And that's the way I thought of myself. So what happened is, so you understand now, maybe it gives a little context, that when she said to me, you come home drunk on that Friday morning, when she said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you, she was fed up. She was fed up, you know? She had been taking that abuse for 5 years. And you'll understand being an alcoholic. Understand if you're an alcoholic and you're in denial and you're selfish and you're self-centered, all you do is think about yourself, you might understand why when I came to that light, I said, what the hell did she mean by that? What the hell did she mean by that? I don't even understand what that she's talking about. Because I'll tell you what, I didn't feel any pain coming home at 4 o'clock in the morning. I didn't feel any pain. And of course, that night I went to the bar at 4:30, and I showed up at 4:30 in the morning, and that was the end of my marriage. And as I'm walking out the door, leaving my wife and my child, leaving my house, leaving everything that was important to me and should have been important to me, the only feeling I had was complete freedom, because now I could drink the way I wanted to drink. You know? And I wasn't thinking about her, and I wasn't thinking about the child, and I didn't think what I was doing to my family. I just thought about me and how I was free. And 3 months later, after the divorce was filed, and she wanted to try to get back together again because she believed in the sanctity of marriage, and she convinced me, out of guilt or whatever it is, that we should see a marriage counselor because it was the thing to do. And we had a son, and I saw a marriage counselor. And then the marriage counselor said to my wife, and I had been going to the bars and drinking, of course now I could maybe jump on some lady or something like that, and I was doing what I always wanted to do, you know, which is real. And you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, you basically live, the way you live your life is you don't do the right thing, you just do what you want to do. And you're a rationalizer, which means you tell yourself rational lies. Somehow you figure out how what you wanted to do was always the right thing anyway. You understand what I'm saying? So you don't, in your mind, you've got some sort of mental thing going on where whenever you do what you want to do, no matter how many times you hurt people, you don't think about how you're hurting people. You somehow figured out how it's the right thing to do under those circumstances, okay? So you don't think yourself as a bad person except deep down where your honesty lives, and you realize you're a worthless piece of shit and you should be dead. You know, that's where the voices come from later on when you're in the shower and you tell yourself you ought to be dead and you're a piece of shit. And that's where those voices come from, all the crap. The voices come from where you're, you know, what does it say? You know, you got a shot if you have a constitution, if your constitution capable of being honest. That's the problem with being an alcoholic. It'd be easy to be an alcoholic if you were psychotic. But, you know, when you got that honesty crap going on, that deep down inside, you know, it's hard not to tell yourself you deserve to be dead when you know you deserve to be dead and you're a worthless piece of crap because of all the people you've hurt in your life. Because apparently there's something deep down inside of me that no matter what I tell myself in the top of my brain, all the way down deep in the bottom of my brain, I know it's all lies. I know I'm lying. I know I'm a bum. So when I went to see the marriage counselor, and the marriage counselor said to my wife, so what are the three things you want to change about, I don't know, they must teach this in like marriage counselor school. What are the three things you dislike about Russell or something like that, or you want Russell to change? And she said the three things, you know, whether it was probably not drinking is one of them, I don't know, coming home for dinner, whatever the heck it was. And I felt that, you know, if I played this game, I was like being pulled back in to that situation. I didn't want to be there. So when he asked me in front of her, what are the things that you want to change about your wife, I said to him, I just want to date other women. And that was the end of the session. I'm not making this shit up. I mean, I'm not making it up. You know what I mean? And my wife started crying. I don't know, whatever. It was very painful. Very painful for me to even sit there and listen to that shit. You know what I mean? You can understand how I feel, can't you? You know, So then we got a divorce, because that's how that's going to end up. About a year later, you get visitation rights, but when you're out with your son, it's really hard to drink, and I like to drink. So one day I told my son, next Saturday we're going to go to the zoo. And I'm going to pick you up at 10 o'clock and we're going to the zoo. And he said, we're going to do the zoo, Dad? And he says, yes, I'm going to take you to the zoo. And I really did intend on taking him to the zoo. But that Friday, I had gone out with a gal named Sally. And Saturday morning at 8:30, she called me up and she said, me and the girls are going out on our boat. Would you like to come with us? And I started thinking about that. You know, the boat, the booze, the gals, and my son. The boat, booze, gals, my son. You know, and I was agonizing over it for about 15 seconds. And then it was anchors away. I was out on the boat with them. And for some reason, I don't know why, but it didn't seem appropriate or necessary to really call my son. So I don't know what he was doing. He was probably waiting for his father. But of course, I was really more thinking about the boat and the booze and the gals. And I figured he'd be happier with his mother. You know, I probably somehow convinced myself, I think, that I was actually doing a good thing for him. He'll be happier, you know, with his mother and everything like that. So the deal is, now that's just a couple of true stories. Those are just a couple of true stories of my life. Now, I did not share with you the only times I've been selfish and self-centered in my entire life, you know, up and through the age of 31 years of age, or even after. I didn't share that. I just shared two things with you. But what I guess I'm trying to tell you, the point I'm trying to tell you is that's the kind of life I led. Now, I was a lawyer. I was self-supporting through my own contributions. I was, if you looked at me, you know, during the day, I was wearing the blue suit and the white shirt and the red tie. I was getting awards. I was getting acclamations. People saying, what a great guy. People liked me. I was respectable. So on the surface, I didn't look like a felon or anything like that. I wasn't going to jail. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a, but essentially what my life, what my spiritual life, the underpinning of my spiritual life was, if you want to know what was really going on with me, is I was a selfish, self-centered, narcissistic, only giving a shit about myself person. That's what I was. So if you wanted to know what I was going to do on any occasion with anybody in any relationship at any time, all you had to do was ask one question. And you know what that question was? What does Russell want to do? I did what I wanted to do. I figured out a way to do whatever I wanted to do, no matter who it hurt. Now, the problem is when you do that, you get into a lot of conflicts with people. You know, letters come in the mail and you rip them up and you don't open them. You know, phone calls ring and you look at it and you say, I'm not talking to that guy. You sort of hide out in your room. You go to sleep, you think about this person and that person. You think, what are you going to see when you see him tomorrow? What are you going to say? How are you going to handle this? You think about all sorts of scenarios. He'll say this, then I'll say this. You think about, you know, how you can make excuses. You're constantly coming up with excuses why you didn't pay the money or why you didn't show up and when you said you would. And, you know, when you live that kind of life, you're just dealing with a lot of, I don't know, it's like one big novella in your mind. You're dealing not just with one conflict or two conflicts. Life gets very complicated. It's a very complicated thing. You got a lot of fighting going on with people. You know, either real, you know, wrongdoings of others really affect you. And there's a lot of wrongdoings out there. There's a lot of hurt feelings. There's a lot of conflict, you know. And 90% of it is like in your brain. It may not even exist. It doesn't matter whether it's real. It's just you are constantly thinking about other people. And basically, they're bad thoughts about them. They're not good thoughts about them. And ultimately, they become bad thoughts about yourself. And half the time, you don't even know you're doing it because it sort of happens automatically. You don't even have to invest much energy in it. You're just sitting there in that doctor's office for an hour, and you're talking, you're thinking about her, you're thinking about him, you're thinking about it, you're thinking about that, you're thinking about your boss, you're thinking about, You're thinking about almost everything that's happening in your life all the time, because there's all sorts of fear and stuff involved in there, and they're all uncomfortable, crappy thoughts about yourself and other people, and you can't stop. It's like drinking. It's not like you can't stop it. If you're awake and you're breathing, you're thinking. Sometimes it's hard to go to sleep. Sometimes you'll be up to 3 o'clock when you wake up thinking about it. You go to sleep thinking about it. That's sober. That's after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? And you know, just go to discussion meetings and stuff. You'll know what I'm talking about. Just listen to people, you know? You know, sponsor a newcomer or something. Just listen to what he says, you know? He starts talking, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, man, and then you got those thoughts about what a worthless, you know, those suicidal thoughts, how you're not worth anything, and, you know, you're worthless, and you're a piece of crap, and you tell yourself all these voices and everything like that. So, you know, and probably 1,000 things I'm not even mentioning, but you're alcoholic, so you live with this stuff, so you know what I'm talking about. So if I've left something out that's going on in your brain, you know, just fill in the blank, okay? Whatever it is that's going on in your brain that's stopping you from living a life of peace and serenity. That's the true alcohol. That's the result of the true alcoholism that centers in your mind, not your body, that stems from your selfishness. So, you know, it says we got to get rid of the selfishness, or else it'll kill you. That's what the book says. It says God makes that possible. And, you know, I talk about God and relying upon him all the time. I talk about that deal. But besides even the, because if you don't get rid of the selfishness, it just keeps on piling up. You know, when you dug yourself into a ditch, you know, there reaches a point in time where you really got to stop digging. You know, you just got to keep piling this crap on yourself. Because you may not drink, but life becomes unbearable. You know, it just becomes unbearable just to breathe. You know, you're living lives of, you know, discontent and, you know, quiet, what do they call it? Quiet lives of quiet desperation. And like a lot of people out there. And one of the things that happens, you know, the Big Book, as you know, before 1939, when they wrote it, where they say, rarely have seen a person fail, it's thoroughly follow our path. The books they used was, that they said were absolutely necessary, was 1 Corinthians 13, the Book of James, and Sermon on the Mount. And most of the ideas come directly, are taken directly out of the Bible. And in Sermon on the Mount, you know, one of the things that said, it says, no, it says a couple things. One thing, doing four steps, it says, don't look at the speck in your brother's eye, look at the beam in your own eye. Don't look at him, look at yourself. You know, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what is wrong, what the problem is, there's something wrong with you. And the second thing it says, if you come to me, God, for help. Remember what it says about selfishness? It says selfishness, self-centered. Above everything, we must get rid of selfishness. Must or it kills us. God makes that possible. God makes that possible. Now, I don't know anything about God. You know, most people don't know anything about God. We come in here not knowing. You know, you learn his rules. You learn the rules. You know, I mean, you know, I don't know who you pray to. I'm not going to tell you who to pray to. I know who I pray to. I know what my idea is. But the interesting thing is, if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're doing this book, whatever God you're praying to is going to be consistent with this book. And I'll tell you one thing. You know, he operates under the 12 steps and the principles within the 12 steps. So whatever God you're praying to, if it's God I'm praying to and you're reading that book, He's not contrary to this deal. And apparently, the person he respects, the person God helps and respects, and whose his spirit transforms, is a person who strives to be unselfish and tries to be a servant and help other people. I'm sorry. I know that's kind of shitty, but I don't make the rules. You know, I'm not this. You know, if I was making the rules, you know, rip, rape, run, do whatever you want to do, and that's the guy he likes, you know what I mean? But no, you know, apparently, and it was lifted from Sermon on the Mount, it says, if you come to the altar to see me, to talk to me, see, a lot of people think they go directly, he says, and you realize that somebody you hurt has something against you, he says, you clear up that deal first. You clear up the deal with your brother, and then you come to me, which actually has a lot of psychological significance, because how can you think about God when you think about that worthless son of a bitch that you had a fight with the other day? You know what I mean? He wants you to focus on him. He doesn't want you to focus on him. He doesn't want split allegiance. He doesn't want you showing up in church and praying to him while you think about that son of a bitch, you know, that ran you off the road. You know, you understand what I'm saying? He knows that you really have sort of like a one-track mind. You know what I mean? And you can think about him. Or, you know, it's like I tell my clients about paying me money as a lawyer. I said, hey, listen, it's very simple. I can think about your case, or my money, I can't think about both. You know, you bought my presents, not necessarily my enthusiasm. So, it's a little lawyer joke, okay? Lawyers like it much better, okay? So in any event, but the point is, you know, the point is part and parcel of this deal to get to the life you want. You don't have to worry about the nuts and bolts of this thing or the details or what you got to understand is if you want to get to where you want to go, just think about the end result. Just think about the end result. See to what your relationship with him is providing. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, don't worry about what God exists, what he doesn't, or what's here, what's there. Just think about a life of fear and worry and anxiety and restless nights sleeping, a life of constantly hunting for whatever that guy, gal, thing that's going to make you happy and never finding it and always being frustrated versus a life of incredible peace. And decide which one you want. Whether you want to be right or whether you want to be happy. Whether you want a life of peace, you know, or you want a life of stress. So if you want a life of peace, I'm sorry, this is the deal. We have a program. This is what you do. And so there came a point in time where I had to start doing these steps. Part of the steps is the fourth step. The eighth step has a basis in the fourth step, which gives you the fourth step. And the fifth step is the first time it gives you some clarity as to what this selfishness looked like in your life. What it looked like. That's where, you know, by the time you're done to, you start off the fourth step thinking you're a victim, right? By the time you're done with the fifth step, you can't even believe that people are still talking to you. You know what I mean? You're so grateful you're still on the planet because you were just, because you go from, you start off thinking you're such a victim, and where do they start you at? They start you from listing resentments against people because they treated you so lousy. And then what's the next thing? How did it affect you? Which is, hey, if you think of Alcoholics Anonymous is a great place for alcoholics, you know? If you're dealing with people that are sensitive and concerned about themselves and concerned about their feelings, where else would you send them but to a place where they could sit in discussion meetings and talk about what's happening to them and their feelings? You know what I mean? With other people who are listening saying, man, I understand what you're talking about. I feel the same way. I mean, it's a great place if you're sick and selfish and self-centered. Just surround you with that self-centered, selfish, disgusting love, you know, that one alcoholic has for another, you know? I mean, you're not being judged. You're kidding. You're being applauded. Right? So you know, that's where the four steps sort of starts. It starts with that resentment and how it affected you and your life and what they did to you, you know? And, man, I tell you, man, that part of the four step, hey, I can do that part of the four step. I've been doing it in the bars all my life. I don't like writing it down. I'd rather speak about it, you know what I mean? Can I just talk? No, write it down, because then we're going to get to the second list. We're going to disregard all that stuff. Disregard, yeah. We're going to talk about where you were a shit, where you were wrong. What did you do wrong? Well, that's a little bit of a tougher deal. So then they got you writing down where you went. What did you do wrong? Start writing down your fears. Start writing down when you were selfish for sexual things and things like that. Man, by the time they get you done the fourth step, you're sort of like, all of a sudden you go from resentments to seeing what's really going on. And then what's even worse is you got to go some guy up into the fifth step. And I'll tell you what, whatever rationalization you have for doing what you did and how it wasn't your fault, well, a good sponsor will take care of that. He'll take care of that deal, you know what I mean? You know, whatever nice guy you think you are, he'll take care of that deal, you know? So by the time you get to the end of the fifth step, now you got this load of crap. Now you've got a new insight into who and what you are. Now, so if you have that insight and you start getting into I'm going to use this word, into an area of true repentance, godly sorrow, not worldly sorrow, not self-pity, not the kind of sorrow you had before the fourth step, the self-pity, poor me, which will eventually lead to a drink, but the sorrow that comes from, you know, being sorry for what you had become and who you hurt. It's a different type of sorrow. You know, after the fifth step, there's much less complaining. Much less complaint. Before the fourth step, a lot of complaining. You hear somebody that's complaining a lot about other people, you just ask them this question. Have you done a fourth step? 99% of the time, the answer is going to be no. if they complain about people. Once a person's done their first step, complaining stops. What's the complaint about? Because they knew who the real cause of the problem is. Now the question is, but the problem is, now you know who you hurt. You know how you hurt them. Now the question is, how do you get rid of, what if you run into them? What are you going to, you're going to live with this thing for the rest of your life? That's where the eighth step, that's where the new freedom starts. That's why in the promises they say you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Freedom from those voices, freedom from those people. Freedom from thinking about them all. Freedom about worried about whether you run into, you want to run into them. You can't wait to run into them because you're ready, because you're willing. Made a list of all people who had harmed and become ready to make amends. So you're ready to make amends. You're willing to make amends. You want to make amends. And then, of course, we'll talk about this next week. And they said, well, how the hell do you do that? How do I make amends to my first wife? I'll tell you about that next week. But, how do you do that? How do you make amends to the family? How do you do that stuff? And when you have all those people in your mind, I want to ask you this. When you think about what's bothering you this week, when you think about what you've been thinking about this, if you're in here, and you've been thinking in the last 3 or 4 days about a problem, does it have to do with people? Does it have to do with people? Have you had something bother you as far as a person or people, many people, a lot of people, been bothering you, you've been thinking of, maybe you've even been talking about it, maybe you can't talk about it, maybe you don't know how to talk about it. Is that the thing that you've been waking up with and going to sleep with and worried about and causing anxiety about? So let me ask you something. How does that feel? Doesn't feel good, does it? So what would your life, if I could snap my fingers like that, and all of a sudden, all the bad thoughts about other people and yourself just disappeared from your mind, never to come back again. How do you think you'd feel? Feel a lot better, wouldn't you? You want that stuff? You could have that. You could have that deal. You can have that deal. I mean, how would you rather live your life? With that stuff going on in your brain, with those people going on in your brain, would you rather live your life free? With that new freedom? The archway of freedom. Because when you live your life with the archway of freedom and all that stuff is drained from your life, then the Holy Spirit can come in and do his thing, transform you. And if you stop being selfish and self-centered and see where you're selfish and self-centered and see what that deal is all about so that you don't do that stuff compulsively, and addictively anymore, then you stop building up that stuff and you live a life of relative, comfort. Does that make any sense? Any of this stuff make any sense? So that's what you want to do. And so that's why the eighth step basically grows out of the fourth step, and grows out of the fourth step and the fifth step. And, we sort of know who the people are, and we become willing, or else we pray over it. And I'm not going to go into all that. You can read it in the book. And next week, we're going to talk about the ninth step and how you do it. So thank you very much.